you have this opportunity that you can do all of these other things. And they started talking, we got to talking, and I said, you know, that sounds really good. And so I moved again. I went to the other arm of the county and went to the hospital district and was able to set up this, we call them full service forensic nursing programs, where we saw everything. We called in the death reports. And so we helped, we looked at every death that came, that happened, and determined, did it meet the criteria? Because hospitals don't, some of them don't really know when you need to call the medical examiner's office. So we did that. We did the sexual assault piece. We expanded into DV and elder abuse. We even went to the trauma rooms when the gunshots would come in, and we would collect evidence with stabs and car crashes and assaults. And so we were doing lots of different things.
Hi, welcome back to part two of Stacey Mitchell's podcast here with the Idea to Impact podcast. Jack and I continue our discussion this week about the important work that Stacey Mitchell is doing in the area of forensic nursing. Let's get started.
The virtual reality sounds huge, because if, and again, I didn't realize until this conversation that when they're doing the simulations, they're simulating on actors, if I can use that word, which means you've got to find, like you said, you have to train these the people that are going to be the standardized patients, and then they have to be available. You might have to, you know, pay them to show up, and I don't know all the different parts about it, but you know, in any business, usually labor is the largest cost, right? Paying people is the biggest cost. Are you using virtual reality to kind of make the simulations more available? Is that even possible with today's technology?
Yes, and that's what we're trying to do. At this point with VR, we are looking with the virtual reality, we are looking to really, we want to try and focus on the task mastery of evidence collection.
Okay.
And then we will be adding into a different module to that, because right now we have three modules that are just about finished being developed. And those are different tasks, different parts of evidence collection, pieces of evidence that you have to collect. And then we want to pull in the next module, the actual examination piece, and try and put it all together. That if you can't get to someplace with simulation, but then you could at least get a feel for it through VR. It's not going to be the same thing as going to a simulation and working with a standardized patient or a real person, but it can at least get you that feel for what the exam is all about and the task that you have to master in order to be competent in collecting evidence and working with patient vulnerable populations.
You're talking about physical evidence collection for the most part, right? Yeah. Because I got to tell you, I have kids. I have a lot of kids, and most of them are boys. And they play these games, you know, where they're either shooting guns or bows and arrow or whatever arrows, and they're doing things in first person simulation. And we went out to go. You know, this is Texas, so going out to a shooting range isn't that strange. If you're listening to this in another part of the world, it might sound strange. We went to a shooting range, and like my 20-year-old was you know, knocking the targets out. I'm like, where did you get the practice to do this? He goes, I've been playing video games my whole life, and that simulation, even though it wasn't three-dimensional simulation, you know, like full VR, he goes, I really have a feel for it somehow. There's an intuition that becomes developed. And I'm assuming it's the same thing, although instead of taking something out, obviously you're trying to help people in your situation. That intuition can be developed, it seems, through you know, even two-dimensional computer simulations.
I would assume that's what we're hoping. That's what we're hoping. Once we get this, the RVR project up and going, we really want to look at that and see what are the outcomes and how do the outcomes work. You know, was it worth it? You know,
right. That's all the testing, right? I'll bet it is. I'm gonna put my money. Unfortunately, don't gamble. But if I did gamble, I'd be putting my money based on what I've seen with my own children, as you are going to do, you're going to do well with those types of simulations, and it's going to matter. Right? Is it going to be the exact same as doing it live? No, but when they get to live, they're going to be more prepared than they would.
It's any better other than way. Nothing. Yeah.
And it's going to build something within them that, again, is this kind of intuition and feel, so that when they then go into three-dimensional space, it's going to feel somewhat natural, you know, to them. That's going to be a really good training tool. Yeah.
And who's developing that for you? Because I do you have VR skills yourself? Are you coding all this?
Right. Is the center VR? Yeah, right.
Through the College of Architecture, they have a visualization department. And so we have collaborated with them and Dr. Siao and her team. And she has some undergraduate students and I think a couple graduate students who are working on the project for us.
And this is the same department of VIS, what you call it for short. Plenty of their, I used to work in that department, and plenty of their students go on to work at like Pixar. Disney. So I bet that they are going to be coming up with some really good stuff for your center.
What we have seen so far is amazing. I will sit there in the meetings and they're showing us, and I'm just in awe of what, you know, the concept we had. Right. And then they're actually making it. And, you know, I'm like, you guys got an A+ for today, you know, and Dr. C, I was like, oh no, this needs to be this. And this needs to be
right,
this. Right. Oh my gosh.
Like, D-.
How did you do that? I'm like, but it's just,
that's a good point. Cause that VIS program, the visualization program is famous for mostly entertainment companies. People know Texas A&M's visualization department for that. This, though, you might be giving them a great opportunity, Dr. Mitchell, to be creating another career path of creating highly technical and accurate visualization simulations for medical training in an era where, you know, we can't always be next to each other, you know, or put our hands literally on something that needs tactile training. This might be a real cutting edge part of the future of medicine and the practice of nursing, just in the implementation of the visual part too, the virtual reality.
Yeah, she's also, her department is also working, Viz is also working with one of the other, a couple other faculty members in the College of Nursing, and they're also developing some other virtual reality. So you're right. It's the next thing that's coming up within, you know, healthcare and, you know, education, and just another tool that can be incorporated to better educate, the future healthcare providers.
And I imagine that the meetings that you have with them, you know, when you're giving them the content of what you want created, it must be very long, but very important meetings, because this is not like a video game where it's okay if what you're seeing is not really how it is in real life. Like think about like all the medical shows that you've probably seen where you're like, okay, that's not really medically possible, or that's not really how things happen in a hospital. This has to be as real as possible, right?
Yes. Yeah, it does. We want to try and make it as authentic as we can. So to give that learner the best experience possible.
Yeah. Yeah. That as somebody who develops curriculum, you know, when I'm designing a curriculum, you know, sometimes, you know, the designing of the final product is important, but, you know, those meetings where you're handing the content from one hand to the other are just important, because sometimes the person developing the program, they don't know anything about nursing or, how to pitch your company to a VC or something, you know, like I think people underestimate how important it is to be able to communicate with the designer what you're needing, what you're looking for.
That's really important. That's one of the things that we've learned, is that you have to be crystal clear when you're talking with whoever is designing whatever you're doing, because for them to be successful, you have to be very, you have to have the communication skills and be able to articulate what it is that you want, because they can't make it happen unless you tell them what needs to happen and how it needs to happen. And it's okay if they get it wrong because they want to get it right. So it's okay to say, oh, no, it needs to look like this instead of this. Mm-hmm. And we found that, you know, in working with Viz, that they have been very, very easy to work with because it's, you know, does this work for you or does that, or how does this need to look? And we've had those conversations, which I think is really going to make the end product really strong.
And you've been talking a lot about us and we. So do you have a team that you're working with at the center?
Center of Excellence.
Tell me the full name. Yeah, the Center for what?
The Center of Excellence in Forensic Nursing. It's our center that's under the College of Nursing. And, you know, having the center has been really exciting because, you know, it's helped us with grant funding and helped us really have, you know, the name, the center, and, you know, people love coming, you know, we're coming to the center to learn and we're like, yeah, that's what we wanted. And so, yes, we do. We have a team. There's four faculty members and then we have a bunch of staff members that we have that are, you know, kind of helping make the magic happen. And it's been really fun. You know, pulling everybody together, strategizing, saying, okay, where do we want to be in 5 years? What do we want to look like? What does the next project look like? And just kind of seeing what's going to happen down the road has been really fun.
Are there Go ahead.
I was going to ask, were you one of the like founding people of the center? Were you one of the first faculty members in this group?
In the center, yes.
Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of forensic nursing programs? I mean, Texas has a lot of big universities. You know, they have universities that are dedicated to medicine and health. Is the center, do you have a lot of competitors in Texas and in the South for this?
No, we're the only center of excellence in forensic nursing in Texas.
Are there centers for less than excellence in forensic nursing?
There must be. Yeah.
Center for that school down the road.
Try harder.
I mean, there's very few formal, you know, forensic nursing degrees. You know, maybe about 20 universities, 20, 25 universities have programs around the country you can study. In Texas, there's us, and then there, UT Health Science Center had a certificate program in forensic nursing, but I think it's been shelved because we kind of took one of their faculty members. We stole her. and so
Center for Excellence in Pirating and Forensic Nursing.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So, I mean, plug for A&M. It sounds to me like if anybody's listening to this or watching this on YouTube and you have an interest in forensic nursing, Texas A&M is this place to come, because not only is it one of the only Center for Excellence in Forensic Nursing in Texas, but you are also doing this cutting edge work with virtual reality, with visualization departments and other interdisciplinary studies that are probably making, again, what you're doing very, very unique for your students' experiences. So I don't want to oversell it. So tell me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like Texas A&M is the place to be if you're interested in.
That's it. Yeah. That's our goal, is to be the place. you know, that's, you know, as we strategize, it's how do we make ourselves or position ourselves to be, you know, the place for forensic nursing education, at least in Texas. And we, you know, we'd love to take over the world and be the place. But, you know, having the center and being able to be innovative has been really, has been great, because we can pull in other experts and partners and collaborate and, you know, just be able to make that learning experience better for our students. And, you know, and people enjoy coming on campus, you know, for education. And, you know, they love, you know, being in, you know, Aggieland and, you know, just what is happening and the next best thing, because they ask us what's happening next, you know, and so, okay, you know.
And you mentioned that you're looking at getting this kind of curriculum that you developed copyrighted or trademarked. Mm-hmm. What made you and your group decide to go that route? Why not just give it to anyone who wants it? You know,
I mean, the work that we're doing is through the center, and I think it's really important that, you know, that we have the Texas A&M name on it, a Texas A&M brand on it, because we're doing it at Texas A&M, and that's important that we have it, you know, protected. I mean, I don't mind, you know, sharing with folks, but it needs to have, you know, Texas A&M on it. Right. You know, they've been fortunate enough to support us in our development of the center, and, you know, the Board of Regents approved it, and, you know, everybody's approved having the center. And it's, you know, it's like, we need to, you know, protect our brand and to get A&M out there again, to make us be the place to come for forensic nursing education.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I would imagine not just because you want to be the best, because it sounds like you already are, but it's also just to protect the material so that they know, mm-hmm. when they're using the Center for Excellence in Forensic Nursing's material, they are using the real mm-hmm. they're using the one that has that is on this cutting edge of the mm-hmm. not only the education but also the technology, the science, etc. It sounds like it's really important for the end user to know that they're not getting the knockoff brand, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, because we put a lot of time and effort into figuring out what works and what doesn't work, and right. you know, and trying to, you know, have the model and be a model program and have the model, yeah. you know, the Aggie model or whatever we're going to call it, you know, is right. really important to us. And so that, you know, we want A&M to be everywhere. You know, we want to bring the spotlight on right. the school and on the college and on the center so that, you know, our success is everybody's success.
How do you go about without divulging any trade secrets or anything that would screw that up for you? How do you typically go about trying to figure out what does work or what doesn't work? Is there a special process that you find, or you kind of take opportunities as they come to try to test these things out? Because that seems like that would take a long time to get to that point, right?
Well, you know, in healthcare, and, you know, we use, you know, rapid cycle quality improvement. So that
rapid cycle quality, hold on, that's a big one. Rapid cycle yeah. quality improvement.
Yeah, yeah.
Can we pause RCQI. Right there and just tell us what that means?
you know, RCQI is, you know,
RCQI.
You know, it's like, okay, you have something that you do, and then okay. you stop and you evaluate it at different points, and you say, okay, is this working? If it's not working, what do we need to change? And okay. then you make those changes, and then you run it, and then you come back and say, okay, did those changes work? And were they successful? If they weren't, what else do we need to change? And so it's this continuous quality improvement process that goes on, and it never stops. So it's not like you do something or like you have a project and you wait to the very, very end to say, okay, did it work?
Right.
And you're like, well, no. Gotcha. Well, you've had all these opportunities along yeah. the way to, I don't want to say fix it, but to change things and tweak things to make it so that it's going to be successful. Mm-hmm. And so, that's what we wow. have done. We made sure after every single one of our simulations, you know, is a feedback session. And, you know, we talk to everyone involved. We talk to the students, we talk to the experts, we talk to the standardized patients, and we say, okay, what worked, what didn't work? What would you like to see happen next? And then we incorporate those changes, and then we come back and say, okay, did that work? Okay, if it did, great. What else do we need to fix? You know, or what else do we need to change or tweak or to make it a better learning experience? And we're still doing that. You know, we constantly, you know, you just constantly do that until you're like, gotcha. I don't think there's anything else we can do.
mm-hmm. Okay. Rapid cycle quality improvement.
Mm-hmm. RCQI. That's going to go yeah. into yeah. my new yeah.
RCQI like
IRS. Yes. Mm-hmm. And Beth, you know, you have your doctorate in education, and so you're probably really familiar with this. And this might sound like a stupid insight that I'm going to make, or a newbie insight, but in order to do that rapid cycle quality improvement, it sounds to me, Dr. Mitchell, like you have to know not just the end objective, but the kind of micro objectives at each point along the way, that for mm-hmm. each task you are hoping to achieve these 1, 2, 3, whatever they might be, things. Or you might be out, you're trying to achieve a certain time, or trying to achieve a certain, you know, minimizing the amount of physical touches or something like that. So you're trying to achieve something in mm-hmm. order to be able to evaluate what's happening. And that must take forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you got to do all that ahead of time, right? Or most of it, I would assume.
Yeah, most of it. When we were, you know, when you're designing your program, you're thinking, okay, what's the overarching goal? And then what are my objectives? And then under the objectives is where you have, okay, this is how I'm going to achieve that. Mm-hmm. And then those are the things that you want to, you know, really evaluate and say, are they working?
And knowing what you're not. Yeah, knowing how you're going to measure success, mm-hmm. you have to know those going into it. You know?
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I say that because a lot of our, I want to say a lot of the people that come to us, that would be an incorrect statement, but a lot of the people that are trying to learn about technology transfer and commercialization of their ideas, you know, we haven't been trained mm-hmm. like the way that you guys have been trained, either by formal education or by experience. And we tend to go toward that end goal only, right? I'm going mm-hmm. to get 5 million widgets on the shelves in 5 years. Okay, that's great, but you know that. But how are you going to do that? And then to keep on breaking it down, you know, step mm-hmm. back, step back, step back, step back, and then, as you said, measure forward, and knowing how to shift and change as you go. That seems like it would be a skill that almost any entrepreneur or innovator would want to be able to master, mm-hmm. to be able to get to where they want to go to make that impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Absolutely. I mean, it's. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's about, yeah, where do you want to go and how are you going to get there, you know, and it's mm-hmm. trying not to get there too fast, because if you get there too fast, then you're going to miss opportunities. And that's one of the things we struggle with is growing too fast or doing things too fast, because we're like, okay, here's the next thing. We have to do this now. And it's right. like, no, we need to slow down and say, okay, how is this working? Because if you can't jump to the next thing without making sure the first thing here or the first project or the first step is really working. I don't know how I learned it. I mean, I learned it probably through doing and, you know, trial and error sometimes. Mm-hmm. That's sometimes the best way to learn things is when you mess up something. But, you know, I also learned a lot too about that when I was working on my MBA, you know, and I had the opportunity to, you know, work with people who are entrepreneurs and, you know, who have ideas and who actually said, go and do this, you know, go ahead, you know, what do you want to do? And didn't try to stifle people, you know, and say, oh, you can't do that. Or I did have people say, you can't do that. And I'm just stubborn and said, oh, I'm going to do it. Watch out. Here we go. And, but yeah, I mean, you have to take your time and you have to do it incrementally, because if you try to do it too fast, I have found that you are going to miss something, and it could be a key component, because if mm-hmm. the right thing doesn't fit in the widget or the widget doesn't fit like it's supposed to, then right. you have 5 million widgets that are useless right. sitting on a shelf.
You're absolutely right.
And it sounds like some of that or a lot of that came to be useful for you when you were starting up some of these new programs, or you mm-hmm. were not new, but like it was new for wherever you happened to be at. So kind of talk about like that part of your career where you were starting these, you know, being brought to Texas or to wherever to start this new program. Mm-hmm. How did that go?
Yeah, I mean, my career started in Virginia, and, you know, of course, I went, you know, University of Virginia, and that was where I had some colleagues that I was working with in a local hospital, and that was where we started our first forensic nursing program. And it was very interesting because the nurse manager of the ER, she was semi-supportive, probably because we bugged her to death, and so we really need
persistence.
That's right. Yeah, persistent. We were persistent. And, you know, and she said, okay, you can do this, but we're not going to pay you to be on call. And, you know, when you're in your 20s, you're like, okay, we'll go ahead and do that. And so, you know, but then we kept saying, okay, well, what else can we do? Hey, what about this? You know, can we incorporate this? And, you know, and we kind of fed off each other and bounced ideas off of each other. And that was how the program really started growing. And then I, you know, I was there for about 6 years working in that role. And then I was recruited to Houston by Dr. Joy Carter, who was the chief medical examiner at the time, to set up a forensic nursing program at the ME's office. And so I had always had an interest in death investigation, and she wanted to have nurses that would come in and really focus on some of the medical issues that surrounded death and death investigation to help determine, you know, is this a natural death versus, you know, a homicide that may be covered up, you know, by abuse and neglect or poisoning or something like that. And we set that up, and working with her, it was very supportive. And then her successor, Dr. Luis Sanchez, who's the current medical examiner for Harris County, was very supportive and saying, you know, let's take this and see what we can do with this. And we ended up having about 10 or 11 nurses, one of the largest cadres in the US, of working in the medical examiner's office. And we were in the process of trying to really focus our investigations or our pieces with the nurses on natural deaths, infant and child deaths, because those are very medically complicated, they can be. And to bring in that medical knowledge and then pull in the forensic piece, you know, was definitely a natural marriage of that. And we built that program. And then I moved to the other arm of Harris County to set up a forensic nursing program with the hospital district, Harris County Hospital District, which is now Harris Health System. Okay. And it had, you know, Bentob Hospital, which is a level one trauma center, which is where you want to go if you're in a really bad car crash or you're shot.
Yep.
And they also have a level three trauma center, LBJ Hospital, and they wanted to set up a forensic program. And they were like, well, we want to do sexual assault nurse examiner program. And when I was meeting and talking with them, it was like, you know, you guys are missing an opportunity here to really expand what you're doing, because think about the populations that you see, the vulnerable populations, and to only focus on one, are you doing a disservice to the others? And that was kind of the question that I left them with at the end of that meeting. And it was, yeah, you're right, we are. Mm-hmm. And I ended up leaving the ME's office and going back to live people. So I went from dead people to live people. And so we were able to set up a program. And this was, you know, this is like now full-time. I'm full-time forensic nursing. I was full-time forensic nursing and with death investigation, and now full-time with this. And it was setting the programs up and really saying, where can we go? And how do you phase things, you know, different populations in, and at what time period are we going to do that? And you're in the process of recruiting nurses and training nurses. And so we were always in a perpetual training mode. Because, you know, we start out with sexual assault, and then we start phasing in child abuse, and then we would phase in elder abuse, and then human trafficking. And we got so that we were actually responding to the traumas, the trauma rooms that would come in. So the major traumas, so the gunshots and stabs and the car crashes, we were there when that trauma pager went off. We would go down and we would collect evidence and document injuries, and then interface with law enforcement and whoever else that we needed to in those cases. And so it was very, very well-rounded, very, very busy when you're seeing all kinds of things happening in a level one trauma center. And that I had so much fun pulling that together, because that was very challenging in working at a system level to integrate forensic nursing, not only in the hospitals, but into the clinics. Because then with the hospital district, they had lots of community clinics, and patients sometimes prefer to go to their clinic as opposed to driving all the way into the medical center.
Yeah.
And so we would respond to those clinics as well. So we had, you know, like 16 or 18 clinics and three hospitals that we were covering. And it was really a challenge to try and embed that at a system level, but we were able to do it. And it was really exciting to, you know, to see it come to fruition.
So just to make sure I heard it right from the story, you had the meeting and you said you guys are missing out on a big opportunity here because they just wanted to stick with sexual assault. Mm-hmm. They came back to you and said, yes, you're right. Is that when they also said, and we need you to do it, Dr. Mitchell? We need you to lead it?
When they came back and said, Yeah, I think you're right. That sounds really good. And I said, that sounds really good. I think I might want to come work for you guys and do
gotcha.
That because
okay.
it sounds like
okay.
a really challenging project. Because I'm like, oh, this is so
I'll
much
bet.
Fun.
Right.
You know, just implementing and building programs and being innovative and doing. At that time, there were very few forensic programs that were beyond, you know, sexual assault. They may see some domestic violence patients here
right.
or there, but they certainly weren't responding to trauma, you know, trauma cases like gunshots and the like. And so we were just, you know, kind of full steam ahead, trailblazing, and that was fun.
So forensic nursing is kind of like the umbrella term, and then it includes things like sexual assault nurse examinations.
Mm-hmm.
And it includes, you know, then you can have somebody who really is focusing on like death investigations where you're yeah. working with dead people. I keep wanting to say like, I see dead people, but you have the other kinds of abuse, you know, child abuse, mm-hmm. elderly abuse. Am I missing one? I feel like I'm missing.
Human trafficking.
Yes.
And yes, you know, and then there's also the perpetrator side too. There is a side in forensic nursing where there are nurses that work with the perpetrators exclusively, and they work in some of the mental health facilities. They can work in the correctional facilities, and so yeah, so there is that. Yeah, you know, it is the umbrella, and
okay.
underneath it, you've got all of these little, you know, areas, sub areas.
What do they do with the perpetrators? I mean, is there examinations they do on those people as well?
It's mainly things to do with counseling.
Okay.
It is working with mental health professionals to help determine, you know, can they be rehabilitated? You know, do they understand the charges against them? Just to kind of help, you know, can that perpetrator participate in the criminal justice system process? You know, can they go to court? Can, you know, do they, you know, do they have the capacity to do that? And they work with the forensic psychiatrist and psychologist. They can also do some counseling at the advanced practice level. And so they can, you know, they can work in, you know, in those areas and work, you know, exclusively with perpetrators.
Okay. Okay. Wow.
When we think of sexual, at least for me, I'll say, when we think of sexual assault, when we think of domestic violence, for me, I typically tend to imagine a female victim.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that might even be statistically accurate that majority of victims are female. I might be wrong on that. Is there a specific training for male victims of these as well? Is it a different mm-hmm. area in forensic nursing, or is it pretty much the same in many ways?
There are some, you know, there are, we do have a lot of male victims,
okay.
and are, you know, individuals who, or, you know, who have been victimized that are males, and
right.
Some of the concepts are the same of how to provide care, right. but there are some specific things that, you know, to that population that you have to do
right.
and you have to consider. And that was one of the innovative things that we did with our simulations is that we were one of the first ones that incorporated male standardized patients so that,
sure.
you know, when you walk in that room, you're like, oh, now I know what to do. Because that was one of the biggest calls I would get from my nurses when I was working at Harris Health was, I have a male patient. What do I do? And I'm like,
mm-hmm.
okay, you know,
right.
you know, it's the same thing. You know, you need to talk with them. You know, you can collect evidence from them, and you know that, you know, what they want to have collected. And then we now have to find resources for males. So you need to go look
right.
at this list that we have posted. And, you know, and we found that some of the nurses, you know, almost become paralyzed because they're so used to female victims or patients. And when they have a male patient, it's now, what do I do? And you're like, well, it's actually an easier exam.
Yeah.
And so that's why, that was one of the reasons, or one of the things that came to my mind when we were working with our, developing our simulation was we have to have a male patient because of the things that we had experienced in the past. It's like, we have to have that because we need to teach
right.
those nurses of how to respond appropriately.
Yeah. It's the same thing with a female victim. You don't want to re-traumatize them by,
right.
you know, belittling them, making them feel you know, especially like for men, because there's that, there, I don't know if taboo is the right word, or like, it's just not something that people talk about, is male sexual assault victims.
We don't think about that, and we don't talk about it a whole lot. But, you know, it does happen and it does occur. And, you know, and we see lesser numbers of males reporting.
Right.
But I mean, I have a feeling, you know, it's the incidents are just as high as for females.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. And this by no means is the equivalent of a sexual assault, but I mean, something like a good phlebotomist, of somebody who can draw blood. I have a deep fear of needles, not going in, but pulling stuff out. And, you know, I'm like, God bless a good phlebotomist. And when there's somebody mm-hmm. who's confident and competent, I feel better, because I'm already really, really nervous about being here, almost mm-hmm. to the point of panicking. And I can't even imagine, if I'm already going through a trauma like a sexual assault, and looking at my medical professional, looking at my nurse, and he or she doesn't feel very confident and competent, I'm gonna start freaking out even more. So mm-hmm. having that confidence, I bet you there are multiple layers of benefits of being competent and confident for the victim's sake, for the patient's sake, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you're able to do all of this, and you're teaching, you probably have quite a large teaching load as well. Mm-hmm. Like, how many courses a semester do you normally teach?
I usually have at least one every semester. And I've been teaching in the forensic courses. Lately, I have, so most of my time has been bought out under grants and contracts. Right. I teach in the forensic courses, and I usually have one a semester or at least two a year.
Okay. So that, yeah, that's the good thing about getting grants is,
yeah,
not that like, you don't, you know, teaching isn't fun, but like, you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, as a researcher here at a place like A&M, you know, you come here and your main objective is to do research, and that can be quite hard when you're also having to teach and do other obligations.
Yeah, it can be. I definitely, you know, feel for everybody too. So it's like, yeah, we're all together, you know.
And do you still get calls to consult on cases, and, or do you have nurses that call you when they're in the field and say, Dr. Mitchell, help me, I don't know what to do? Or are you involved in like preclinical stuff, or, you know?
I am. We work very closely with the Attorney General's office and their Sexual Assault Prevention and Crisis Services Division. And we have a couple contracts through them where we provide some services, where we do a lot of consultation for the nurses throughout Texas. So if they have practice questions, and if they send the question to the Attorney General's office, then they will forward it over to us and to the center, and then we'll answer those questions. We have a lot of nurses that just call us and say, hey, I have the practice issue or a question, can you help us? And then I do some consulting. I do some legal consulting. So I'll work on some cases, you know, for attorneys, and review cases and help, you know, educate them as to what they need to know and how, the types of questions they need to be asking of their experts.
Okay.
That's a question that's been in the back of my mind for forensic nurses. I'm assuming there is a legal element of the training. And I mean, there could be legal elements of the training as far as protecting yourself from liability, but you're collecting evidence for a legal case, right? That mm-hmm. may or may not come someday, but your job is to collect that evidence properly so law enforcement can preserve it, right? For the DA to maybe do something with it later. I'm assuming that it's not just a matter of the, if you will, the art of collection. You have to know what to collect, how much to collect, how to properly collect it without tainting it for forensic mm-hmm. reasons, et cetera. Is that part of the training that the forensic nurses go through, or do they do that later in continuing education? How does that work?
No, that's part of the training. Okay. And that's part of the simulation too, is to learn and to know what to collect, how to collect it, how to preserve it, how to package it appropriately, how to maintain chain of custody. Mm-hmm. All of those things are part of the training. And then we developed a mock testimony course. So that they actually get to go and testify.
They have to testify.
They have to testify in court. Part of the for the certification for Texas is to be have courtroom observation. And we thought, well, okay, observation is nice. And it's nice to go to court and observe, but you really do not get the feeling of what it's like to be sitting on the stand and having someone ask questions to you. You can watch and see and say, oh, I don't know if I can do that. Well, let's put them on the stand. And so we developed a course that is a mock testimony course now that's about 2.5 days. And they learn from attorneys. So we partnered with the Brazos County DA's office. And so they provide some lectures to the nurses. We lecture to the nurses. They prepare for a court case. And then the last day, we all go to the courtroom. This was when we could do it in person. And now we just do it through Zoom. We do virtual court. And we all go to the courthouse and they practice. Every single nurse gets to practice qualifying as an expert. And then they get to practice delivering direct and cross-examination testimony by real attorneys, practicing attorneys. And they get, and we have a case, a simulated case that they prepared their testimony for, and they get to actually get on the stand and practice. And then they receive feedback immediately from not only the faculty that's there, but the attorneys as well to say, okay, yeah, maybe next time say it this way, or, you know, I didn't understand when you said this, that's why we kind of stumbled over here. And it gives them that really, that flavor and that feel of this is what it's going to be like when I get on the stand and this is what I need to do to prepare.
Mm-hmm. Which is, you're, you know, now kind of a little bit in my field on the legal side. I do know that when it's quote unquote your witness, you know, when the state or the county, when the DA is calling the witness, you know, you have a nice relationship, right? And you've been prepared in advance, and you know how to say it, but how to talk. But when you have the adversarial side coming in, and someone's trying to destroy or at least poke holes in for the sake of reasonable doubt, whether things were done correctly, if an expert looks shaken, that might be enough sometimes for a finder of fact, like a jury, to have questions about, well, was this done correctly? You know, so I bet you there's a whole bunch of that needs to be practiced too. How do you maintain composure? How do you answer authoritatively? Mm-hmm. That's an awesome part of the program, I think. It sounds like it's something that's really you can go through all of that process. Mm-hmm. Of forensic collection, chain of custody, et cetera, but you've got to carry it all the way through at the trial to make it count of it.
Yep. Yes, you do. Yes. If you can't talk about why you collected what you collected and why you did what you did, then it's not very useful, you know. No one's gonna understand.
Yeah. I bet the attorneys have fun with that. Cross-examining or, you know. And it's funny, I had to go in and do, for grad school, in my qualitative research course, we had to go in and we had to observe an hour of something and then write 20 pages, single space, on what we observed in that hour. And I went and observed a courtroom. I had a friend at the time that was an assistant district attorney in Brazos County. And so he said, yeah, we've got this case that's actually going to trial if you want to come in and, you know, it was like a drug case or something. And I think it ended up being pleaded out, but it's not like Law and Order SVU, you know, it's not, there isn't no objection, you know? And so if I was, you know, training to be a forensic nurse, I would be very appreciative of that course because, you know, I don't want to go into my first, you know, actual real case expecting to see this huge dramatic and event when it's, you know, very That's much good. Not really like that. I mean, it was very boring. You know, there wasn't like this buzz. There was like nobody else in the courthouse that day. You know, I think it was actually a day where it had snowed or something and there was a huge delay, but yeah, it was not what I was expecting.
Yeah, no, the red herring is not going to, you know, and the confession like in Perry Mason, that doesn't happen.
Right. Surprise witnesses, those are not allowed.
Yeah, no, but it can be very, very stressful because you don't know what's going to be asked of you. And if you haven't had a chance to experience that, then, you know, your stress level is kind of, you know, 10 times that. I mean, I remember the first time I testified, it's, you know, I I think I was, you know, my heart was like 200 beats a minute or something. It's like, it was really stressful. And, you know, it's like, what can we do to reduce that stress for these nurses? And,
Yeah, I would be very stressed. My friend, I have a friend who she used to keep up to date and manage all of the like breathalyzers in our county and like the surrounding counties, and, you know, the ones that were in the jails, ones that you actually use when you got to jail. And, you know, she talked about all the time about, oh yeah, you know, I was in Austin today and I had a court, and we were always like, man, I can't believe you're just so about it, you know, like, yeah, day at the office. And she's like, y'all should have seen me on my first day of court.
Yeah.
You know, like, she's like, now I know what to say, and now I know what not to say, and how to be very, you know, you only state the facts, and you no opinion in it, and it's just what you observe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's a skill to be able to give a testimony. I mean, it's great that y'all have a course on that, because it's definitely, I don't know, something that comes naturally to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it takes practice. I mean, because you can say the wrong thing, or if there have been motions and stuff pre-trial, and you know, and you're not allowed to say something and you forget and you say it, you could actually cause a mistrial. And you know, and you don't want to be the one to do that. You know, it's like, that nurse, you know, you don't want to be that person. And so you want to make sure that, you know, and so we're hope with that testimony course, which we feel is very innovative. You know, that you can, that at least the learners are getting it, that feel of it. And they're at least saying, okay, this is what it's going to be like when I go to court. And we had some really, you know, unintended consequences with that, because the attorneys, they actually learned too. You know, with Brazos County, they had some newer attorneys. And so they got to practice questioning, and we would watch them as they would evolve, because they took turns being defense and prosecution. And you could see them evolve in their tests, you know, and as they ask questions throughout the day, and they were like, yeah, I really learned how to ask it this way, or I really learned that. And so there was a lot of learning on their side as well, which we didn't really anticipate or really think about until we were actually sitting there observing that, going, this is really cool, you know, what's happening.
That kind of, you're right. That, I mean, it's going back to, you know, your program doing simulations and not just like, you know, I think it's the having the standardized patients, as you call them, where it's somebody who's trained and they know what they're doing, because that's completely different from, you know, doing a role playing, like in a course where you're role playing with your peers and they're, you know, they don't really know what they're doing. And that kind of reminds me of, you know, College Station does the wet lab. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. And I guess they, you know, they have their standardized patients, because they bring in citizens and they get them intoxicated. And then they have the new cadets, the new police hires, practice doing sobriety, field sobriety tests, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's things that, you know, you learn in school, same for nursing, that, you know, in the textbook, it goes one way, but and you know what you should do, but when you're in the real world, things aren't always like a textbook,
right?
And you know, your patient isn't always going to be compliant, you know, the context may be different or something may go wrong. But yeah, it's just so, like, I mean, just really what you're doing. Yes. Talk about us having this is like one of, you know, we have guests that are doing cool things, but Dr. Mitchell, your program really is something that's, not only are you like changing the field of nursing, but your program is having a major impact on the community.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
You hope so. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the goal, is to, how do we change things in the community? You know, I mean, even through one of our other projects that we've got, I mean, we've actually created equipment that's being patented, you know, I mean, and it's through our telehealth arm of the center, through TextTrack, which is our tele-remote assistance center, that's being led by one of our other faculty members. And we've created a new piece of telehealth equipment for sexual assault exams that, you know, we're patenting now, and it has a patent pending, which is kind of cool. And, you know, so yeah, we are trying, you know, we are changing the landscape, and it's all because of trying to, you know, seeing that gap. You know, there's a gap in, you know, in care, and there's a gap where, you know, there's not enough access to care. And in trying to close that gap, I mean, that's, you know, that's where we see, you know, the innovation, and that's where we see, okay, you've got to be creative in what can you do to meet those needs. And being able to just kind of have that support of, yeah, go ahead and do it, you know, has been exciting, you know, to just, let's see what happens, you know, let, you know, let's see how we can do it. If it doesn't work, then we'll shift gears and go at it from another direction.
That brings me to something else you said earlier, and I know it's an adage amongst in the entrepreneurial community, I should say the entrepreneur community, that the best skill an entrepreneur or an innovator can acquire is knowing when to say no to an opportunity, because there are always going to be many more opportunities than you have resources to work on a solution for that issue, problem, whatever it might be. And you can't spread yourself so thin, because then nothing really gets done.
Right.
How do you at the center make those decisions? And you said something earlier about that too, that you have so many new ideas. Like, we know we have to put that off to the side because of X, Y, and Z considerations. How do you know when to say no to an opportunity, or no for now, right?
Yeah, that's the hardest thing, you know, because you want to do it all. And, you know, you're like, we have a list. We generate a list as we're talking. We'll say, write that down. You know, we got to remember that. And so we have this really long list of things, and, you know, and we get, I think, you know, we say no, or we put it on the list because we know that we could, it's a good idea, and that it's something for the future. And we look at, okay, what is the mission? And we try to stay really grounded to our mission. And what do we have happening now? And is it possible to add something, or is it just something that has to wait? And, you know, we kind of have the absolutes, the nice to have, and the, yeah, no, that's not, you know, if we have time to get to it list. And that's kind of how we try and prioritize things. You know, what is, you know, what's mission critical? What is, you know, is it something that has to do with a grant? Is it something that has to do with, you know, a course, or, you know, what, it, where does it fall in the, in that continuum? You know, cause we, you know, cause our main job, you know, obviously is to educate. And so, okay, if it falls in with education, then yeah, obviously it's a priority, but if we have, it falls as part of a grant, that's also a priority too. And if what we want to do isn't part of that, then we know that has to go over onto the list of, we'll get to it as soon as we can. And then when we have time, then it'll be, okay, let's look at the list. What do we want to do next? And do we have money for that? And where can we go find some funding for that? But yeah, it's hard to say no. It's hard to know what to say no to, but you know, you could find yourself extremely overloaded very, very quickly. And there have been times when we've had to sit back and say, oh, that's really, really good, but do we have the bandwidth to do it? And that's a hard look at your, you know, at yourself. So you have to work as a team. And yeah, you know, nurses, you know, we work together as teams within the units, as nursing teams, and helping each other, you know, making sure that things are done on the shift. And so, yeah, we do, you know, I've been working as a team my entire career, you know, or on a team, different teams. And so, yeah, that really does help, because you have to be able to work. You can't do it solo.
Yeah.
You can't.
It's exhausting.
Well, it sounds like you have a good team there. I mean, what's next for the Center for Excellence in Forensic Nursing, and for your team? What do you have coming up on the horizon, or what do you have that you really want to make people aware of at this point?
Let's see. We'd like a vacation, but
every 10 years.
Every 10 years I get a vacation.
We had that snowpocalypse a couple months ago. That was your vacation.
Yeah, that went fun. No electricity and no water. That was not a fun vacation. That was like camping, but cold, you know? What's next is, you know, we want to really enhance our virtual reality. We want to finish up the module for the female patient, and then we want to do a module for male patients under VR. That's the next thing that's up for us. We've got some other, our research arm of the center has got a few good, great projects going on. And then I think it'll be time then to go back to the list, you know, to say, you know, what is next, you know, what's the next thing that we can do, to help meet that mission or to help augment some of the projects that we already have going or that are ending or that are just kind of on, you know, autopilot and, and kind of go back to there. But that's, you know, those are the big things that we really want to do. We want to keep expanding the center, because our goal one day is to become an institute, and be that, because we're like, that's, you know, what else is there, right? It's like, that's what we want to do.
Next step.
Yeah, that's kind of the next step. But yeah, I think the VR piece is the big thing that we want to continue to explore and expand, and then look at some other, just try and identify some other gaps that we can try and close a little bit.
We'll have your contact information in the show notes, and whether if you're listening to this right now on an audio only platform, you can go to the show notes. And if you're on YouTube in the video platform, you can see that in the description. So anybody who's interested in the field, you know, as a career, I certainly recommend you that you reach out. Is it okay if they reach out directly to you, Dr. Mitchell?
Absolutely.
Are you teaching in the fall the forensic nursing course, or is it in the summer?
We have a lot of continuing education courses that we have going on right now, and we have some that start at like every 5 weeks. And then we've got classes in the fall that are for forensics. So yeah, I may be teaching. I may still be on a bunch of projects. So we'll see.
Right. So if you're interested as a career, or you're interested as a nurse getting into this area, or if you have practice questions and you're, you know, in Nome, Alaska, you know, we have experts here, especially in Dr. Mitchell. So I encourage everybody, take advantage of some of the great resources we have here at A&M.
Yeah, we do have some listeners in England, so you never know, you know, who you may be getting a phone call from. So
true. At what time, too?
Yeah, that's true. That's right. That's awesome. Thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate
thank you. This has been a great show. I learned so much.
Yes. And if I, you know, I'm sure we said it before, but if not, I want to emphasize what great work we think you're doing. And thank you so much, because it is important work. And thank you for, you know, taking the time. I know it took us a while to get you on here because you are so busy, and that's great. You know, it's a good thing as faculty to be really busy. So we really appreciate you taking time to speak to us this week.
It was my pleasure. This was fun. Thank you again for the invitation. And I'm glad we're able to do this.
So thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next week.
All right. Bye. Sounds good.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.